Welcome to episode 29, Podwarp 1999, The Motion Picture. We have Jim Francis of Outsider at OutsiderComic.com.
Good evening.
Mark Meckes of ETIPI and Zordic at ETI-PI.com and Zordic.com.
Hello.
We have our guests tonight, Tara Talon of Galaxian, which is GalaxianComic.com.
Yep. Hi.
Hello. And I'm Tom Truskowski, StationFeed3.com, and it's Assorted Spinoffs. So, welcome to the show, Tara.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Yay.
So,
it's kind of funny to be here. I'm used to just listening to you guys, and now I have to talk back.
Yes.
That's right.
I got to say stuff.
Yeah.
You can point out our mistakes directly to us.
Yes, as we go along.
You can say, what are you talking about? And we'll actually hear you.
New and exciting. So, tell us all about Galaxian.
Oh, I know this question was coming.
Of course.
Is it just me, or is this like the hardest question in all of comics? And someone comes up to you and says, so, tell me about your comic. And I just blank. All right. The short answer, I'll give you the short answer. It's a science fiction webcomic, which I guess is not a surprise, given the podcast theme. It's about the crew of a quirky little science ship. It's called the Galaxian, hence the title. It's a little bit about the characters' lives, a little bit about their relationships, and it's a lot about this new experimental engine that they have to take on this test run, and they discover that it doesn't work at all the way they thought it should. And that's kind of the short answer. It is, I guess what makes it different from a lot of the other webcomics that I see is that it's not the sort of grim and dirty and gritty kind of science fiction. It's very, well, I guess, very Star Trek kind of feel to it. It's very, very tame, and it's very all ages. And the funny thing is I didn't plan to write it that way. That's just the way it came out, and it didn't occur to me that this was unusual. But when I look around at the other comics out there, and not even just comics, even the movies and stuff that we see, it's all Battlestar Galactica kind of Firefly stuff, and mine just seems so tame in comparison.
Not miserable enough, no explosions, and well,
yeah,
there was that fire, right?
A little bit of explosions here and there.
Yes,
but mostly it's a character story.
Yeah,
that's what I have the most fun with is dealing with the characters and telling their adventures.
Sure. It started out as a print comic first, didn't it?
It did. Actually, well, to go way back, it started out as a novel that I was trying to write when I was, 12.
Okay.
And it stayed being a novel up until I was in university. And around about there, it was my cousin, Franz, who, I had been reading comics all along. But he was the one who wanted to be in comics. He was more of the superhero kind of reader. You know, he liked all the DC heroes, and I read some of that. But I liked more of ElfQuest was my thing, and the Viz titles were slowly starting to come out, and that's what I liked more. But he had the dream of one day drawing Spider-Man and stuff. Mm. So he started to put together a little portfolio, and at that, it had never occurred to me before, even though I enjoyed comics, that, hey, maybe I could do this too. Even though I'd always done pictures to go with this novel that I was writing. And I think that comes from reading the Back to ElfQuest. They had a novel come out way back when, and that was full with pictures. So I thought, well, if she could publish a novel with pictures, I can too. So I did all these pictures. But it never really occurred to me until my cousins sort of prompted me into it to try it as a novel, and with him sort of spurring me on, I did up a couple of sample pages, and we took them to a local convention here in Toronto, and I just guess I got the interest and the fire from seeing other people doing the same thing.
Sure.
And I saw a lot of people doing mini comics, and while at first I thought, oh well, geez, this is for people who can't really get into comics, but it quickly became apparent to me that that's most of the world. There's a very, very thin market for people who can actually get into comics, and anybody else who has some interest, this was actually a really good way to go. And that's what we started out as, doing little mini comics.
Yeah.
Cool.
Now you're redrawing it now, or?
Yes, this is the third time I'm redrawing it, because I did them as the little mini comics, and then when I switched to full-size comics, because I wanted to get comics into the comic shops, I wanted to go through Diamond and have it distributed all over, but I couldn't do that with mini comics. When I changed it, I was changing not only the size, but also the length of each story. In my mini comics, we had done them as sort of flip comics, so I had half of this book, and then you'd flip it over, and you'd see my cousin's story on the other side. So each issue was about 14 pages, and for a regular comic, you need about 20 to 24. So I ended up redrawing everything for that. And then I did that for 13 issues, and then in about 2000, I stopped because we started a family, and I quickly discovered that I just can't have kids, and or babies anyway, and comics at the same time. I don't know how. There are other people I know who've done it, other women I know who've done it, and I don't understand how they did it. Maybe they had much nicer, quieter babies or something. I don't know.
Hey, no, don't blame the babies. Don't hate the babies.
Anyway, so after
hate the
I got old
the
enough.
Babies. How old are your kids now?
Oh, they are now 8 and nearly 5. So they're at a very good age to start reading comics, and actually we have read them many comics.
Almost to the point where you can start putting them to work, you know, doing like cleanup stuff, can't you?
At 8, I don't think.
No, the opposite of cleanup, it's the dirty with the old God. One time I came downstairs, and this is where I discovered what it's really like to be a parent and under control, is come downstairs to my pages, because I work with paper and pencils and inks and things as opposed to doing everything digitally. And discovered that my daughter had added her own little impression to the whole page with my ink, with my expensive pens. And
oh boy.
Before I had kids, I thought to myself, oh my God, I would freak out if that ever happened to me. And I discovered that I could actually take this in stride. And Photoshop is a wonderful thing.
Ink has no undo button. I don't like that.
No, it doesn't.
Well, it's called whiteout.
Whiteout,
yeah.
Whiteout.
Yeah. There's only so many times you can go over that, though.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, what you do after that point, if the whiteout fails you, then you take another little piece of paper and you stick it on top.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
So at what point did you switch over to computer stuff?
It was 2006 was the point where I decided that I was ready to go back to doing something, and I did spend some time deciding, do I want to go back to the novel, or do I want to go back to comics? And I looked around in the comic world, which I'd pretty much been entirely out of for 6 years, you know, hadn't been even to a comic shop in about that long, but after talking to a lot of people, I realized that what I had been doing before, which was the print comics and through Diamond and the other distribution companies and that kind of thing, it wasn't the place to be anymore. It wasn't very accommodating to independent self-published comics. But I realized that most of my friends had now gone, who had been doing self-published comics at the time, had now gone online. And I was quite surprised to see how much there was online at that point. So I decided that I would try doing that. And I started out at Girl-O-Matic entirely because a friend of mine was on Girl-O-Matic and she liked it. It was a good starting point where I didn't have to worry about building a website or anything like that. And they already had a community. So I just started there and slowly started doing comics. But what I didn't realize at the time was I thought I had to start over because I was reaching, I thought it would be a whole new audience. That 6 years had passed, no one would remember this print comic, and I couldn't figure out a way to start where I left off. That was my first thought, that I could just take the story where it had ended and find a new way to begin it from there. You know, the whole idea of you start, the best place to start a story is in the middle. But it turned out that I didn't work out well because it was too far into the story already. So I just said, okay, we'll just start all over again and fix all the things I wanted to fix the first time, add other elements that I really wanted to add, and redid it. And it was only several months later that I realized what I could have done was just taken everything that I'd already done and uploaded it and made it archive. It didn't occur to me. By the time I'd already made the commitment, so I just kept on going. Should have done more research.
Hi, Ben.
Hey.
I'm awesome. I'm so sorry, guys.
We're all here. Can we do that?
Wow.
I don't know if it's
physical. Whoa, okay. I'm not going to lie to you guys. I'm scared.
So the short version of the episode so far, this is Podwarp 1999, the motion picture, and Tara does
a
comic.
Now because we got the biggest budget.
Yeah.
Going.
And Tara does a comic called Galaxian, which used to be a print comic but is now online.
Ah, cool. I think I've read that. In fact, I'm fairly confident I've read that because I think I'm one of the people who said, "Hey, let's get Tara on. She's awesome."
Right.
I think you're right.
Thank you. I thought it was tradition that you never read the comics of the guests.
There is that, but I'd also read it separately and independently. I think we may have spoken on Skype before, actually. Have you done any of the sequential artists pub things with Krishna?
Yes. I haven't called in, but I've done the chat.
I thought you were one of the people. Sometimes whenever I did it, we would sometimes do the after party where we just hang out on Skype and invariably end up reading Fail Blog. And it's usually me, Renee Engstrom, I think either Tom or Mark have joined us on occasion, and mm-hmm. I thought you had, but I guess I'm full of soot and lies.
I'd done the chat, but I am still new enough with this headset thing that the idea of calling in is kind of scary.
And yet here you are.
And yet here I am.
Breaking it in.
Oh, this isn't even bad. You know, actually, the bad one was last Wednesday. A guy that I used to know from back when I was doing the print comics, who is a producer for our local version of the Sci-Fi Channel here, Space, the Imagination Station, asked me. And actually, he used to do this show back for our local cable channel called Prisoners of Gravity, which you may have heard of. It was a pretty good show in the science fiction circles. Anyway, so he called me out of nowhere and asked me to do a TV interview. And, I mean, you can imagine, if I kind of get panicky about doing a podcast, me in front of a TV camera is bad. But, you know, don't say no to that kind of thing, so. Wow. I'm feeling a little easier about this one.
Well, it's good because you don't have to actually do anything apart from occasionally pretend to know what you're talking about. Which is how I've done every podwalk.
Yes.
So we were talking about we were talking about switching to online, and you started redoing it.
And how I should have done more research before I tried.
Right. So, I guess I haven't read your entire archive, but it looked like a lot of the pages were scanned in. Is that not the case, or it seems like the newer pages look like they were done digitally, and the pages I was reading before look like they were inked and scanned. Is that not the case?
Oh no, everything's inked. I mean, I do scan them in, and then sometimes I'll make minor corrections. Like I've done more recently, I've been adding tone. That's kind of a new area for me. Actually, right. Changed my art in Photoshop. But no, everything has a physical piece of paper, the old stuff and the new stuff. So I'm swimming in comic pages.
But you did go back and put some of the older stuff in with the new stuff, right? I seem to remember.
That's true. I did. When I first launched, I took I think it was a 13-page short story that had been in print, and put that up immediately into the archive so there would be more than just a page when I launched. And I think that was actually a good idea. And I did that again over the summer when I needed some time off from doing the comic. So I did a rerun of one of my old short stories.
Okay, maybe that's
interesting.
Of course, for anyone on the web who hasn't seen it in print, it's all new stuff anyway.
Yes.
So.
And the plan
and
is
so. Also
be in print one day.
I guess the advantage it gives you is it means that you've already got a buffer. So like you said, if you do need to take some time off to recuperate or just to relax for a little while, or you get sick of drawing the characters or whatever, you've got the artwork there. So it's just a case of, you know, scanning it and getting it up. You don't have to worry about the tedium of actually, you know, making the art because you've already done that, but you did that a bit ages ago.
Well, it's all... It's the same story, but it's slightly different. So I can't just use the same art from before. I think I may have one or two other, maybe only one, short story that I haven't done yet. Anything else would be part of that long story that I couldn't just put up randomly. Unless, you know, hey, look at all this really old crappy art. I think you only have... people would only have limited patience for that. No, actually, this past summer, when I did that long rerun, it was because I was doing a comic that somebody paid me to do. It was wonderful. It was a job. This was for Scholastic Canada Education. It's not the Scholastic that you'll see in the stores, but they were doing a unit for... this for sixth graders, and this is again in Canada. So this was a 40-page graphic novel about Canadian astronauts, and it was I was given a lot of free rein with this. Just I was told, okay, make a pitch. You know, this is going to be a story, but with lots of facts in it. So have fun, do what you want. And so I immediately said, okay, I'm going to set it in the future. They're going to be on this spaceship, and they're going to be studying the astronauts of the past. And, of course, I had to make them Canadian to make the excuse why are they studying Canadian astronauts instead of, you know, the ones that people actually know.
But
because clearly in the far future, Canada is the big power in space. They
well,
the
to,
rule
that
the
would
space
have to be
station.
Science fiction, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So, There have been Canadian astronauts? Isn't that... I mean...
Yes!
how could you fill 40 pages on Canadian astronauts? I mean, how many have there been?
10. Actually, eight that have gone into space. 10 altogether in the program.
But they went up
on... Well, the other two are what? Substitutes?
They went up on your spaceships, yes. They went
okay.
up in NASA
that
shuttle.
Doesn't count then. I'm sorry, please continue.
No, they paid me a piece of money. It really counts. I had fun. But the thing that was most challenging for me, other than the fact that I had to produce 40 pages in this, for me, very short amount of time, was I had to do it in color. And that was brand new to me. And I've done wow. color paintings, you know, for my comic covers. But that was, again, you know, paper and paint and a physical thing. This is the first time that I had to try to do this in Photoshop, and so that was sort of trial by fire.
So since this was done for a school, is it something that you could put online for people to see, or is that not an option?
I did put up some sample pages on my LiveJournal blog. I don't know how much I'll be able to... I don't think I'll be able to post a lot of it because it's their property. And ideally, it'll be seen at schools all throughout Canada, which I know that's not such a large audience. But anyway...
That's seven schools.
Seven schools. Almost one in every province.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And some of them, they teach you how to read as well, so that straight away, that's, you know, a lot of people who may be able to read your comic.
It's a long walk to Saskatchewan, so I have to go to the... Anyway.
This is actually something I'm seeing more and more of, is comics in the schools. Partly, I mean, a lot of the teachers are taking the point of view that this is a way to get kids who aren't strong readers more interested in reading. And, you know, that's certainly very valid. I'd like to see more comics in the schools just because they're good entertainment and good stories. But actually, the comic I'm working on now which is another gig that I'm getting paid for, is another Canadian education thing, but this one is for grade 11 now, and it's an economics textbook, of all things. And I've been asked to provide some comic pages for this. And I guess, again, the idea is to try to get the attention of kids who wouldn't normally be interested in picking up an economics textbook.
Space.
So economics in space?
No, not this time. I was this time I've been given more direction. And this time they were handing me the script rather than I get to write it myself.
There does seem to be some new interest in comics as sort of a medium for explaining things. I don't know if you guys have seen Google has a web browser project, and I'm blanking on what the name of it is right now. But is it Chrome?
Chrome, yeah.
On their web page, explaining what the project is, they have an online comic by Scott McCloud.
I heard about it.
And it goes into some fairly technical detail as well. It's not just a Chrome for Dummies. It's really intended for a technical audience, I think. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Very nice.
Well, when you then think about it, they've been using comics for that kind of thing for a long time, like those little fold-out things you get on planes that explain where the lights are and where the emergency exits are. Those are all comics.
Well, yeah, sort of.
And one of the examples that I gave to some fifth graders that I was talking to comics about at our local library here, I showed them one of my son's Lego instruction manuals,
yeah,
which tell you how to build it, and that's all comics.
Yeah, those are definitely sequential art.
Yeah, and it's a lot faster to explain it with pictures than it would be with words. Because if you tried to write out, you know, okay, now take six thing brick and the red one, not the blue one, and put it this way, and, you know, you'd be writing a whole novel. So with the pictures, it's very efficient. But most people don't think of that as comics.
Do a whole NaNoWriMo entry on putting together a little ambulance or something like that. I gave up on my NaNoWriMo entry. 3 years in a row, I think.
Exactly the same thing here. I had to give up. I couldn't do it. I ran out of steam. I was distracted by steam. I was playing Left 4 Dead, and I've just been hooked. And I had to give up. And it was interesting, because I originally, at the end of October, I decided I was going to write a sci-fi story, which would eventually become an issue of Jump Leads. So I've had this idea floating around in my head for ages. And then I changed tack right at the last minute and decided, you know what? I'm going to do a story about a wizard who is a door-to-door salesman. And he sells epic quests, and nobody wants to buy them. And that was going to be my NaNoWriMo. And I think I wrote 1,090-something words. And then Left 4 Dead came out.
So for those of us in the audience who don't know what you're talking about, what is whatever that word, your NaNoWriMo or whatever the heck that is?
NaNoWriMo is the National Novel Writing Month. From the 1st of November to the end of November every year, people are invited to try and write, how many words is it, like a 80,000-page novel? 50,000-page novel. It doesn't have to be about anything in particular, it just has to be. And as long as you reach the word count, however you do it, you could...
I don't think it's 50,000 pages. I think that would be a lot.
No, 50,000 words, I mean. Sorry.
So it's basically a 24-hour comic day for writers.
Yeah, except it lasts a month.
Except it's the whole month.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much sums it up nicely in an inaccurate, wholly wrong sense. But yeah, that's a nice summary.
I keep wanting to try that, but I don't think I have the ability to work on a comic and work on a novel at the same time. I can't separate those two artistic things. You know, either I've got everything in, if I put my comic completely aside for a month, I could do that. this is, you know, me not being able to multitask, which we chatted about earlier, that I can't actually do what Jim's doing and work on my comic while I'm chatting. I don't have that kind of brain. And I can't do it with, you know, either my all goes into I'm in writing mode now and I'm going to write, or it's in I'm drawing mode and I'm going to draw. Mm. I don't know if that's...
Well, perhaps you could novelize your comic as you go along and go into a lot of description.
No, I think that's why I like comics, is because I don't have to do all the description.
Oh, well.
My paragraphs of description are not a lot of fun to read.
I can relate to that. There was a point when I really liked writing descriptive narrative, and now I'm so used to writing scripts, I get bored writing the descriptive. Oh, the ship was lined with 1,000 rivets, each one plated in fine... No, I'm bored now. I'm just going to write, interior spaceship night control room. A spaceship control room. Meaning Llewellyn enter, that's all I need to do. I'm happy with that now.
Yeah. I admire the writers who can do it. You know, like I'm in Terry Pratchett mode, and I'm all the Terry Pratchetts again, all the Sam Vimes, and I'll go into those again. And I'm loving that. And he, amazing descriptions. He is brilliant. But I'm
going to marry you, Tara. I am probably the biggest Pratchett fan today.
Already married.
Well, you're going to have to get divorced, and then I'm going to have to marry you, because there's Pratchettry is a word I've just now invented. I'm a huge fan of the show Pratchett.
I saw on Vine, I happened across this, did they do a Color of Magic movie, like the way they did Hog's Watch?
They did.
Hogsfather?
Yeah, Sky in the UK, they did another miniseries. The first episode is the Color of Magic, and the second episode is the Light Fantastic.
They've done two. Oh, I love The Hogfather. I really, really want to see this. Except I don't really like The Color of Magic. That wasn't exactly my favorite novel.
Well, yeah, the Color of Magic was more a sort of poking fun at fantasy. It's kind of like how Ian Fleming started off the James Bond novels by making fun of spy books and then got stuck writing them for the rest of his life. And Terry Pratchett started off making fun of, you know, high fantasy, and then ended up making his own high fantasy, which is pretty much his bread and butter now. So it's the irony of that is not lost on me.
So the way to start out is to start making fun of something, and you'll be successful at it.
Which is why I've started with Jump Leads, which makes fun of some things.
Something.
And now, hopefully one day I intend to write an episode of Doctor Who. And it will be made and everything. That's going to happen. You mark my words, $20, by the way.
Does it make fun of things? I didn't read it that way. What are you making fun of?
Specifically, the second issue mocks the kind of confined space of a spaceship where you're being chased by a monster. And it just kind of... The complete... I'm not going to ruin the climax for people who haven't read the second issue yet, but if you haven't, a wizard did it. The whole point of that episode of that was to do the get that idea out of the way. There's a monster running loose on a spaceship, and just write that story, get it out of the way, and then just totally make the ending just this lackluster, disappointing thing.
It wasn't disappointing. Well, okay, maybe to the reader, wasn't
just. Well, that's good. I wasn't actually aiming for disappointing. I didn't want to play into the cliche of we got to kill it, or it actually wants to hug us. I wanted to do something completely different with it.
For my 2001st comic on Sunday, I threw in a monolith. Of course, it's a 2001 reference. I mean, going a little with, you know, I guess you could say making fun of 2001 a little bit, and I've been informed today I've got some of the continuity wrong with the later novels.
Oh, that doesn't count.
Yeah.
The monolith wasn't supposed to fall over yet, because that's not until... I don't want to spoil it, so...
Hey, you haven't read 2001 novels by now. You know, that's your problem. Actually, I only read up to the second one, and I was like, it's getting silly. I'm going to stop now.
Good choice.
I have the third one somewhere. I don't remember if I've read it all the way through or not.
How many have there
been? I'm guessing not. Four of them?
Have there been four? Okay.
I think so.
I don't remember. Yeah. I might have read. I think the third one was when I gave up and said, yeah, all right.
There was 3001 was the last one? I don't know.
Sounds right.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Something like that.
Yeah. Oh, incidentally, Tara, The Color of Magic is currently out on DVD, but only in the UK.
Yes, it's on that DVD is on Blu-ray.
It will eventually get a release over here. I know that Hogfather's finally out over here.
Yes.
But we're still waiting for The Color of Magic to come out. But it came out in England back in... When was it? What's the release date? Amazon.co.uk tells me it came out on the 3rd of November. They're lying, of course, because they said they'd emailed me, but... Well.
But that sounds promising. It seems as though it's a series. I worried that the Hogsfather would just be a one-off Christmas special thing, but they're doing more. This sounds good.
Oh, actually, they're doing another one now. Do you want to know what the next one's going to be?
What's the clown car? Sorry, what?
I tripped over my own tongue. The next Pratchett mini series. I'm just going by what I've heard, but it sounds like it's going to be going postal.
Oh. Ooh, really? Oh, I love that novel. Yes.
Yes.
I'm happy.
I've heard rumors about casting, and again, this is not confirmed. But the rumor I've heard is that Moist von Lipwig is going to be played by David Tennant.
Really?
Oh,
ooh.
Yes. I think David Tennant would be fantastic. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that is unfortunately just a rumor. But maybe we'll
get
lucky.
That would be pretty awesome.
They haven't. There's no casting that's been. The only casting that's been mentioned is Jeremy Irons is coming back as Vetinari. He played Jeremy Irons played the Vetinari in Color of Magic.
I'd like to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, you need to. It might be worthwhile trying to find it some other method. Nothing illegal, of course. That's that.
Oh, of course not. No.
I certainly don't advocate the use of programs such as uTorrent, where there's an easy search field where you can type in what you're looking for, such as the Color of Magic miniseries, and it will appear, and you can download it and watch it on your PC, or if you've got like an Xbox, you can transfer the video file and watch it on that. I don't recommend you do that at all. That's illegal.
It would be wrong.
That would be bad, yes.
Immoral, illegal, and bad.
Yes. So.
But I'm going to buy it as soon as it's available. Give them
of
my
course.
Money.
Yes. And even if I had downloaded the program illegally, which I'm sure you'll all agree, is not something I would do. I'm a moral, ethical, upstanding British citizen and a green card holding American. Except I'm not American. I'm a green card holding Brit. You can edit that later. But I, even if I had downloaded it illegally, I would definitely buy the DVD. In fact, I'm ordering it now out of a sense of guilt. I honestly did not know it was out. Oh well. Actually, I'll buy it when I'm in England. There's no point. We've kind of seriously veered off our subject matter.
Well, yes.
No. What do you mean, me, white man?
Mark, don't play games. It's all your fault. It's you and Jim. You always do this. You take us off on those silly tangents. Talk about Quark. And this is what happens.
Well, you know, give you a little rope, let you go.
It's not a proper Podwarp without a tangent. So I watched the third episode of The Star Lost the other day. Never mind. Okay. But I did. It was good. Anyway.
Okay.
Actually, we could sort of tie this back into one of our topics, which was science fiction movies that are kid-friendly.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Been talking about that on the forum.
Yeah, I remember, Terry, you brought that up. Did you actually find one?
We haven't chosen one yet. This, again, was me and my science fiction interests invading the school because they wanted to come up with a theme for their... They do a dance, it's a fundraiser thing for the little kids. And they needed a theme, so I was there, and of course I suggested space!
Yes.
And as a reward for raising the money, they do a movie for all the kids. They do a movie day, and they bring popcorn and everything, so we had to come up with a science fiction movie. And yeah, I mean, there's Star Wars, but everybody in the world has seen it, you know, at least 12 times. And E.T. was the other suggestion, because I bet you most of them haven't seen it.
Yeah, probably not.
It's old enough.
You know what I think? Apart from if you ignore a few minor examples of colorful language, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Would you believe I've never seen it?
It's actually.
But I think colorful language would be a problem.
Yeah, that would.
Is there any foul language? I mean, there's plenty of innuendo, and they talk about 69. But was there actually any foul language? I don't recall. Whether you show it to the kids or not, I recommend seeing it. It's a very fun movie, and I thought it was pretty clever for what it was, and I enjoyed it.
They're doing a remake as well.
Yeah, that was not so good.
They're what?
They're remaking Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Are you talking about the sequel, or is there a new remake?
This is a remake of the first one.
Okay.
But it's not that old.
But they've run out of ideas.
They should just do a third...
Bill and Ted's not quite as excellent as the first one adventure.
Bill and Ted's mediocre escapade.
So,
but Jim, you posted a nice list of science fiction for kids, and I have to. A lot of them I looked up because I sort of knew them, like Batteries Not Included or Silent Running and Explorers. They're movies that I was sort of familiar with, but I didn't know enough about them, so I went to Rotten Tomatoes, and they were almost all of them given bad reviews. So, which is not me saying that, you know, you're recommending these bad movies, but I'm wondering, is this a trend in science fiction movies for kids, that they're all bad?
Well, when you review, I mean, a lot of reviews are... I mean, some of them are not the best movies in the world. I'm trying to think of one in particular that was on the list that I knew wasn't a great movie. Actually, it was the one that I think Tomer.
The Black Hole?
Black Hole, yeah. There are different criteria for an adult watching a movie and a kid watching a movie. And Black Hole, I watched as a kid and I liked. And it's not the strongest movie from a science point of view. It's
Black Hole was another movie that I never saw because it seemed to be one along the lines of those disaster type movies, which always scared me as a kid.
This one has cute robots in it.
It is a little bit. It has a darker element, and they're you know, there's a big scary robot, and people get killed. So I'm not sure that it'd be the best choice for movies, but you've got the little for best choice for kids, but you do have the little sort of cute robots and. It's a Disney movie, so that's what it was designed for.
Although yeah,
it's a little dark.
And you can always press stop before the trip through hell. At the end.
Yeah. Actually, yes. Apparently, black holes lead to heaven and hell, depending on whether you're a good or bad person. And also, you can breathe in space. This is what we learned from watching Black Hole.
Well, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If you get sucked out of a ship, your hair will kind of, you know, blow a little bit, and, you know, she'll still be able to breathe. We also learned that from watching Star Blazers, or rather, not Star Blazers, but in the Japanese version, there's a couple scenes where they're just outside. Like, okay, hello.
So is the conclusion on the list that all of our suggestions are just no good?
Well, I might watch some of them myself and see what I think. Some of them were like The Rocketeer. That was a great movie. But I think we would, for this event, we would want ideally something that's more, you know, it's spacey.
Yeah.
as opposed to just sort of science fiction elements. But I guess there's Wall-E's coming out, or is out now.
Oh, Wall-E.
On DVD.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
oh, Wall-E, Lilo and Stitch.
Except, of course, we'll have the same problem that every kid will have seen it.
Right.
Well.
But,
I tried to put every movie on the list that I thought would be appropriate for children, but like, there's not a lot, so it's kind of slim.
Yeah.
Actually, I have the same problem with books for kids. Science fiction books for kids. There's not a lot of them. There's tons and tons of fantasy, but not so much science fiction for kids who are like younger than 13. After 13, you can pretty much read almost anything. But within reason. But
there was a series of children's science fiction books like easy reader level even. I think it's maybe the late 70s, early 80s it came out. I can't remember any titles or author. There might have been someone named Harriet in there. This isn't very useful. I remember there was a little amorphous blob character in there. That's one thing I remember.
Alan D.
Well, that's all incredibly useful.
Yes. Yeah, Alan Dean Foster's Humank series were kind of, I thought, were pretty good for younger audience. They were.
That's still novel length, though, right?
I'm
talking of the young adult, younger reader,
chapter books,
somewhere between chapter books and the short books. Novels.
Yeah,
and that's a bit when that topic comes up. Usually, we hear, oh well, some of the Heinleins are good, and I think Isaac Asimov did a series for kids as well, but these are all old books, and I wonder. And it's all fantasy now. Nobody's really writing science fiction. Not science fiction that's taken very seriously.
Well, I think science fiction
that I have seen.
I think it's kind of got pigeonholed into the the Alien, Terminator sort of science fiction slash horror. Actually, if you go into a video store, science fiction and horror are usually the same aisle. Maybe it's because it's gone in that direction.
I think
you're right. Oh, actually, I do remember back in the days when Star Trek The Next Generation was around, there was a series of Starfleet Academy chapter books.
Yes! I had one of those.
Were they any good? They didn't look like it, I have to say.
They were great when I was 10. They were fantastic. Actually, the first one I had Geordie LaForge in it, and it was Capture the Flag. That was the title of the book and also the theme. It was basically a real-life game of Capture the Flag on a Starfleet Academy training exercise in building teamwork and partnership and all that wonderful gubbins. And it was basically one of those like after-school specials about gym class and looking, not picking on people just because they're different or they're disabled or they're a giant, hawk alien or something. But it was set in space and it featured Geordi it basically started off with Geordi being despondent that he's the last person picked for dodgeball or some redundant crap like that. Then him and his class will get to go on a starship because they're going to another planet where they capture the flag. A bizarre incident happens while they're on the ship, but then it turns out it was a drill. Whoa, shocking. And then they're on the planet playing capture the flag. And there's always, how you get in these after-school specials, you always get the bully who's like, I don't like you because that's my character type. There's that character in this book. It was just, I reread it recently, it was just bad, but I loved it when I was 10.
Wasn't that also an episode of Galactica 1980?
That
surprised me.
Actually, I think they're using the Starfleet Academy series of novels as the basis for the remainder of Battlestar Galactica Season 4.
Ooh. Okay. Good to know.
Yes.
I think it would be nice to see more novels chapter books like that, except not part of any kind of, Star Trek or Star Wars universe, but something by one author, one person's vision kind of thing. And a series of those would be wonderful.
Also not crap.
Well,
yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, not crap would be good. I would be very appreciative of not crap.
Yeah. I think if we're going to do that, if we want that done, Tara, we're going to have to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there's it's kind of a hard leap to make from, you know, people thinking of, you know, children's entertainment and, you know, making children's entertainment actual quality. You know, usually you just think, just make it simple for kids and it'll be fine, you know, but...
Wasn't there a third or fourth series of Tom Swift books? That might be science fiction for... I mean, it is science fiction for kids. I don't know if how recent it is or if it's any good.
Yeah, I don't know if they've done a very recent one. The last ones that I recall were maybe early 90s. And I have to admit, I never tried them, so I don't know if they were any good.
More recent than any of the ones I've read. So.
Exciting.
Exciting, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm a parent of kids this age, you know, getting to be that age, so I'm very interested in this kind of thing. More science fiction, please.
Yes, I think kids need to be exposed to sci-fi at a very early age. I was brought up watching, you know, Doctor Who, 20 Bucks, Star Trek, The Next Generation, sort of, but not quite, Red Dwarf. I kind of discovered that on my own when I was a little bit older. But, you know, I grew up watching this kind of stuff, and it stuck with me. And it's like how, you know, when, you know, our grandparents or whichever were, or great-grandparents or, you know, however old we are, when they were kids, they saw, like, Western films and stuff like that on the television. So that's what they grew up with, and that's what they've always had a fascination with. Now, you know, we need to be making sure our kids are seeing the sci-fi so as to ensure that sci-fi remains awesome.
And that they never, ever kiss a girl.
That is that. Well, if the girls are watching sci-fi, then they won't kiss girls either. Oh, God, we've killed all the lesbians.
Success!
Success! Comics can move this way. You know, like 20 years ago, the thought of girls reading comics was still kind of, whoa, that's, you know, this is weird. She can't be normal. But now it's perfectly acceptable. There's tons and tons of female webcomic artists and writers and things. So if they could do it in comics, you know, doing it in science fiction is not that hard.
Do you think it's still relatively mainstream, though? I mean, you're...
Girls do comics now, but they do fantasy, they do romance stuff. So
they do slice of life.
They're not reading... which is great stuff. But back when comics were superhero only, they're like, girls don't want to read that, and they don't. And frankly, I don't either. So it's getting girls
I read it. I read it some of the time when it was actually interesting. there was a time when I thought superhero comics were good. And, you know, there are ones that I would show my kids. I remember the New Teen Titans was one of my favorites, and Alpha Flight because they were Canadian, and I thought that was pretty good.
All my Canadian friends love Alpha Flight.
Yeah, it's
kind of funny. I love Alpha Flight.
It's possible to write superhero comics that appeal to women.
Oh, it is. I love
Matt. But I think they're trying too hard now. So they have to stop.
Matt Wagner's Mage was...
that was really good.
I mean, it was, you know, an Arthurian sort of pseudo-modern fantasy thing, but at its core, it was a superhero comic. And it was really good.
It was very nice.
It was very different from anything that had come before, or at least anything I had seen.
It had a nice style to it that I enjoyed.
I agree.
But I remember back to books, the sort of science fiction book, no, it was science fiction, that really influenced me was Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, I read that copy to death. I love that book. I loved the characters. I loved everything about it. And I mean, it wasn't, you know, real science or anything, but it sort of felt like it. It felt like it could be true.
Did you read any of the sequels?
Oh, yeah. I read all the sequels. I read anything I could get my hands on. And most of the sequels didn't, they weren't the same. You know, I read them and they were okay, but it was the first one that I loved.
I know there was. I liked the Wrinkle in Time, but I remember there was one of those that I just never finished. Started three or four times and stopped around the same time every time. Maybe it was a swiftly tilting planet.
I didn't enjoy that. I didn't enjoy it because the main character Meg, that I really loved from the first book and the second book, she was doing nothing. She had
stuck at home, right?
Stuck at home and absolutely not part of the excitement anymore. You know, she's grown up now. She's a mom and she's done. You know, her life is over.
Yeah.
That's just great.
She died.
I thought she was gonna go. She was supposed to go on to be this scientist or mathematician or something. You know, like her mom was this famous. I forget which kind of scientist, but something. And that's what I expect her to be. And I was very disappointed.
Yeah.
Swiftly tilting planet.
You know the best way to deal with that frustration?
Throw the book at
angry
the wall.
Well, there is that. I was going to say angry letters, but, you know, whatever works for you.
And there was the...
You know, it's funny when... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
There's always the fourth book where they all stay at home and do nothing.
And there was a fifth one as well.
A swiftly unemployed planet. Tangent.
But, you know, it's a funny thing about writing letters was something that it never would have occurred to me, you know, back then. But now, that is absolutely the first thing I would think of too, you know, because everybody's online, everybody's got a website, everybody's got a blog, and it's so easy to just fire off a letter.
Start a petition or a Facebook group or something, you know, that no one ever is going to look at.
But it's, you know, I find it very, I don't know, interesting that so many of my favorite authors now are online and you know, they feel more like people, or, you know?
It's quite scary. I mean, like, Neil Gaiman's got his blog. Terry Pratchett still sort of semi-regularly posts to his old Usenet group, which has been going since, like, the Dark Ages. Who else who writes? Stephen Moffat, who's written for Doctor Who. There's the clown car. Stephen Moffat lurks occasionally on the Doctor Who forums at Outpost Gallifrey.
A lot of the Doctor Who authors are online.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
It's so odd to me. I think when I was little, I had the idea that writers, people who became writers, did so because they were, you know, like introverted people who maybe they had a speech impediment. They just weren't very good at communicating verbally, so they turned to writing, you know? And this made total sense to me. So I was quite shocked to learn that, you know, some of my favorite authors were actually very good public speakers.
I thought you were going to say something like, it really is such a strange turn of, you know, events, you know. Now, almost every writer is on the internet, but 50 years ago, hardly any were.
Okay, guys, I've got a topic for you.
Okay.
E-books. E-books and the Kindle and the Sony e-book reader and all that. Do you think this is the way of the future? Do you think that one day we're going to be reading, if not all, most of our books on little devices like that?
No.
No.
Why?
No.
I think eventually, but in the short term, I don't think so.
Eventually...
Like, not in our lifetime. The thing is, I don't like sitting reading a book on a screen or a display. Case in point, I'm currently learning to drive. Well, I'm not learning to drive. I'm learning the stuff I need to learn in order to get permission to learn to drive. And I had the driver's handbook, and I had a PDF of it, and it was so difficult to read. And then I got the printed version, which has a picture of Governor Arnold in the, you know, on the inside front cover. And, you know, I can read that fine without any problem. I have difficulty focusing if I'm trying to, like... I know this is kind of, you know, a contradiction of terms, because, you know, I read so much media on the internet, like blogs, comics, you name it. But if I'm sitting down and reading, like, a book, something like, you know, a novel or a collection of short stories or, like, this that DMV book, I can't do it. My mind will not let me process that information.
Okay, so there's Ben, always... Sorry, but Ben, you were no. Jim, you were no. Mark?
I will confess that I do have a PDA that I carry, that I have ebooks on and read on occasion. You know, just for the convenience of having it, you know, a little bit easier to carry than a paperback. But now there's something about having that you can flip forward and cheat and read the ending first and, you know, look at the pictures. You know, I don't think it's ever going to replace paper.
And what about you, Tom?
For me, I'm going to stick to paper for the most part.
No. So have any of you ever used one of these devices, the Kindle or the ebook reader?
Saw one in a store. Does that count?
Like I said, I just use a PDA, but I haven't used the big one.
The reason I mentioned it,
occasionally read stuff on that, but I would rather sit and read a book.
Yeah.
Because I was of the same opinion until I actually tried one out, and well, I didn't try out the Kindle because it's not available in Canada, which sucks. But and also I have a friend in New Jersey who is a librarian and is very much a book person. And she owns a Kindle, and she absolutely loves it. And after hearing her talk, and after looking at this thing and realizing, hey, this thing is pretty good. You know, it's almost like paper, and unlike my screen here, I can, you know, read it from any angle. It's just kind of like shiny paper, but you know, any angle, and you can see it, and it looks like paper, like shiny paper, and it's very, very readable. But she was going on about how the convenience of going on a trip and not, you know, wondering which of my, you know, I want to bring 20 books, but I've only got so much room in my luggage, but if you just bring this device, you can bring all the books you want. And, you know, and being, going somewhere on the train and suddenly deciding, hey, I want to read the latest John Scalzi book. And fitting, download it, because you've got the wireless connection that comes with the Kindle anyway. And you can download it from wherever you are. And you know, a couple minutes later, you have a book to read.
The problem I have with that is that, and it's the same problem I have with digital content in general, is that I don't feel like I own anything. I don't feel like I have and this is perhaps a very materialistic point of view, which is kind of weird because I'm not a very materialistic person, but I don't feel like I have anything. I feel like I have data. I don't have anything tangible. There's something nice about looking at my bookshelf and seeing, you know, all my DVDs and all the games I've bought and all the Terry Pratchett books that I've bought over the years and, you know, novels and so on. And there's something immensely unsatisfying about loading up a device and looking at a list of things I've paid for, but that only exists as these pixels on the screen. It feels kind of wrong. Because that's not the same as a bookshelf. And again, that's a contradiction, because I'm quite happy to buy an album on iTunes, but if it's a band I really like, or if it's like a soundtrack to a movie, I will go out and buy the physical album because it's nice to have it on the shelf. You know, I don't feel like I have anything if it's digital.
However, Ben, all of us are involved in doing exactly that with webcomics. We're putting stuff out in electronic medium. And so, you know, we've all kind of dabbled in some print, but essentially we're kind of relying on that kind of going to the internet and looking at our stuff on a screen mentality.
Yeah, but we're not as computers.
You know, it's something that I always found interesting, how many webcomic creators out there who do webcomics and do them regularly, but they hate reading them online. No, you know, there's so many of them that they don't read anything. And I'm wondering, why are you doing webcomics if you don't enjoy the medium? And I've never understood that.
This is funny. I was actually thinking about something very similar earlier today. Actually, while I was in the shower on my way to Quiznos, was thinking about how there's no. I'm doing. Webcomics was not my first choice for Jump Leads, as anyone who's listened to the podcast will know, or has, you know, heard me ramble on about this before. I wrote Jump Leads for television. And I was thinking earlier about how if I'd had the money and the time, I probably would have cast, filmed, produced, you know, a pilot for Jump Leads and just put that up on the internet and hope that would garner enough interest to, you know, attract it, you know, some producers for television or something. I fell back to webcomics as my secondary medium, which is, it was kind of natural to me because I like sitting down and reading webcomics. I have a large number of comics that I've been reading for a great many years. But I, you know, webcomics was not my first choice, and I find myself wondering with a lot of people who are in webcomics if it was their first choice. There are a number of people out there who are doing webcomics who I assume would have preferred to have been in a newspaper first, or there's a lot of webcomics, and I was talking to, twittering with Chris Straub about this earlier today. There are a lot of people who aren't really familiar with comics, but who feel like they have a story to tell, so they try to use cinematic, I'm blanking on the word, cinematic techniques in their comic. And I'm not talking about things like wide-angle shots or establishing shots or anything like that. I'm talking about something, what, the first page is like a character doing something mundane like tying up their shoelaces. And then the second character, the second page is black with like Joe Bloggs Presents. And then the third page is the character drinking a glass of milk. And then the fourth page is a Joe Bloggs production, and then the fifth page is that character going, and so on and so on. And the first 19 pages are essentially the opening title sequence. And it's like, are you making a comic or a movie? Pick one and do that.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the. I wouldn't even think that it's people who don't know how to make comics. I tend to think that it's comic artists who suddenly feel the freedom of the web, where you can do that, and it doesn't matter. You don't have to squeeze it into 20 pages anymore. You know, you can take as long as you want to tell your story, and which doesn't mean that it's getting any better. But I know I've felt that way, that I really enjoy not having that constraint. You know, I'm not tied to the print model where everything has to be done in eights or something. I can do a story that's 32 pages, you know, which in a comic, a printed comic, wouldn't make any sense. You'd have to fill the other 8 pages with something to make it fit properly. But on the web, you've got freedom,
right?
Which can be a bad thing.
The whole open canvas thing. I think the whole open canvas idea. Infinite Canvas, the idea that we have this huge sprawling space as artists that we can just toy around with. And I'll be honest with you, I've never, ever, ever seen a webcomic do that. They always decide to do, okay, well, I'm going to do 3 panels or 4 panels or a page. I've yet to see a comic that is really taking advantage of the whole open Infinite Canvas idea. And the only place I've seen that is a comic some guy did on DeviantArt, where it was basically a character. First frame was the character having a sip of coffee, and then the second one is him shooting out of the frame, and then it's this blank space of just him whizzing around on this huge sort of white expanse with a coffee cup in his hand, and then he lands in the third panel in the bottom right, like far away from the first 2 panels. I thought that was brilliant, but you don't see enough stuff like that on the internet. I'll see if I can fish out the DeviantArt link so that, Tom, I assume you're editing this episode. I'll email you the link so that you can include it on the show notes. But you don't see that happening. You know, the internet is this... Sorry, you go ahead, Tara. I've talked for too long, which is, you know, 3 words.
I was going to say that. I've seen that I've seen that technique used twice, and neither time recently. I've seen Scott McCloud do it, since he was, I think, the first person to talk about it and say, hey, we can do this. And he did that as I want to say it was a sequel story to his Zot series. He did another story, but did it online, and there was, I don't know, 5 episodes of it or something. And he used that. And what I liked about it, the way he did it, was because you had to scroll down, it was like a page turn. You know, you couldn't see what was coming. Unlike on a comic page where you can see it all in front of you, at least a printed comic page, you can see it all in front of you, and it's not a surprise until you turn the page. But each panel, or at least each set of panels that fit on the screen at one time, was like a beat, and then you'd have to scroll down to get the next beat, and it was a very good read. And I think he also used the movement as part of the story in some places, like with the character falling, and that added to the feel of, you know, I have to scroll down, this character's falling, what's going to happen next, and it was very well done. The other place that I have seen an infinite canvas kind of thing was in Shannon Garrity's Narbonic. There were a couple of her strips like that where she did that, where you had to, because normally she does a little newspaper style strip, but a couple of times she did something fun like that where you had to scroll down to see what happened. And again, it's like a page turn, because you want to, you can't see the joke or the punchline or whatever, you have to on your screen, you have to scroll to get it.
Yeah, but it's nothing that you
can. I don't think I've seen
that you can't also do with a page turn.
Yeah, it's just a different feel.
Well, I'm glad we got that settled.
Actually, I'm going to go back to a slightly earlier topic. Ben, you were talking about doing your webcomic as because you couldn't do a TV show. But I am seeing more photo comics. Is that what you call them? I'm not sure. But
okay, I think so.
Photographic, photo web comics that look like a lot of production value has gone into it. And I'm wondering if you think that's essentially a TV pitch or something? Are these people who wanted to make a TV show but couldn't quite get it together, so they do a webcomic?
The photocomic thing is an interesting beast, because people who do photocomics are, there's a combination of people. There's the kind of default sort of, you know, like stereotypical person doing a photocomic is someone who can't draw. Someone who feels like they've got a brilliant idea, but they can't draw, so they're going to take photos of people and use that instead. And then the other type of person who does a photocomic is someone who's doing it because they think it's interesting and different and clever. So they're taking photos of people because they think that's going to help them to stand out. And the other type, because I don't know how many types, so I'm just kind of thinking of them off the top of my head, are people like Bernie, who does Alien Loves Predator, where he's doing toys and taking photos of his toys in a very kind of, you know, robot chicken kind of manner, where he's just got the toys together and that's it. He's just photographing the toys. I've said he's photographing the toys about 7 or 8 times in that small block of speech. And I guess maybe there are other people, you know, people who genuinely think that photo comics are cool, which is cool because, you know, they are kind
of. There's one that I have seen that's come along very recently called Union of Heroes. And it's theunionofheroes.com, and I like it. I think it's out of Germany, and it looks really well done. You know, it looks like they've got all the proper lighting. They've got, if not, you know, amazing actors, actors who are pretty good, and who are not bad at communicating in this format. And you know, they've got sets and they've got sort of special effects, which are kind of cheesy, but they look okay because it's a webcomic. And I've seen another one, which I don't know the title of, but the same sort of thing. It looks like a lot of production has gone into it. And I'm wondering, is this somebody, they wanted to make a TV series and instead did this kind of thing.
I think it would be foolish to say that's like the only reason anyone does anything is because they wanted to do television. Ultimately, the reason I'm writing is because I want to write for television. But I was doing my first webcomic, which I've actually now taken down from everywhere forever. We've had this conversation before. my first webcomic I did because I like drawing, I like writing, so I combined the two and I did a three, four panel, you know, semi-regular comic strip. Whereas now it's, I like writing and I just want to get it out there. Ideally, I would like to be writing for television. I'm not. My fallback position is webcomics, because I really think that webcomics are an important medium. But with people who are doing, like, with any type of comic, you could say, the reason Scott Curtis is doing PvP is because he wanted to do an animated series and he couldn't. You know, you could say that. It's the same principle. And, like I said, there are many reasons why people decide that they want the medium they choose is going to be photo comic. And most of those reasons are stupid. They're not really, I'm kidding. I like photo comics, I read A Softer World and Alien Loves Predator when it was running, and everything else sucks.
I'll be getting the hate mail now.
And hate.
Why aren't webcomics an important medium? Why do you say that? What is it that you think is going to change the world?
The thing about webcomics, and I don't want to say this to sound, you know, pompous. Webcomics are defining storytelling. Right. No, that's stupid. No, the reason webcomics are important is because it's allowing people who wouldn't usually be in a position to tell a story, perhaps, to tell a story. It used to be, oh, you've got to publish a book. Oh, you have to have a comic strip and that has to be syndicated. You have to send your comic to like 50 bajillion, companies before one of them considers the possibility of maybe, perhaps, you know, accepting it and putting it in syndication. With webcomics, you can put what you want up on the internet directly for people to see it. They have to be able to see it. They have to be able to find it first. I think that's an important factor. No one can talk about your comic if they can't find it. They can't give you feedback. But you'll either reach a position where you have, you know, one person who absolutely adores your comic and then no one else on the internet knows about it, or a million people know about your webcomic and hate it, Control-Alt-Delete, and or you can have any number of situations, but the fact of the matter is, you've got your work out there. It's just there for people to see, and it's brilliant. You don't have to send it to a million editors. You can just bung it on the internet, market it however you please, and hope that someone somewhere likes it. And that is why the internet is an important medium, not just for webcomics, but for the media as a whole. I mean, Felicia Day doing The Guild, you know, do you think The Guild would have made it onto television?
I don't know what The Guild is.
Okay, that's a fantastic example. All right, moving swiftly on. But The Guild is, I will confess, I haven't actually seen The Guild either. I know what it is. But
World of Warcraft.
Yeah, it's about a bunch of people who play World of Warcraft. To be honest with you, that is not the sort of thing that would make it to television. It just wouldn't, because it's not mainstream enough. But because it's up there and it's on the internet and people know about it and they can see it and they can watch it, and then they can buy the DVDs and the T-shirts, and right there, those people are doing something which is legitimate, because they're doing something they enjoy. They're doing something people enjoy to the extent that they're willing to put their money down. And that's exactly what is happening. It's kind of like television, except, like I said, there's no one to say, oh, you have to change this to make it more appealing to mainstream. No one can cancel that show, ultimately. The only people who can cancel it are the viewers. If they get fed up with the show, they just stop watching and the show is cancelled. And it's the same with webcomics. You either do a story because, you know, you enjoy doing it, or you do it because you enjoy the fact that people enjoy reading it. But you have this this unique position, which isn't really unique because everyone can do it, of being able to put your stuff out there. That, like I said, is why the internet is an important thing.
It used to be that we did it with little photocopied comics, and we take them around to comic conventions and put them on assignment in our little stores.
True.
But so you could reach people in your own town, but now obviously you can reach a wider audience, so it kind of changes the scale.
Yeah. It does, yes.
I think a lot more people have seen Station V3 than online than have seen anything I've photocopied, for example.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Although, actually, while you mentioned Station V3, Tom, is it basically now just the Rumor Monger show?
No.
It just, I mean, I don't mean that bitterly. It just feels like every comment you've done for the past 2 months has been mostly the Rumor Mongers. No, I'm I think those are brilliant characters. I would just like to know if the reality wave has turned everyone into Rumor Mongers.
I think we saw the station recently, you see.
Yeah, we did. I'm teasing, but it, like I say, that.
But the, yes, I do. I draw them a lot, yes.
But it's not easy to draw.
Yes, but I do.
I'm not.
I know it's something I have thought of myself actually from time to time. You know, this thing. Gee, I draw these guys a lot, but I do draw them a lot. But I try to go back to the station at least every now and then to give these guys something to talk about. But no, it's not just their show. There's other stuff going on.
It's interesting that this comic is called Station V3 and we've seen very little activity actually going on in Station V3. It's like tuning into Days of Our Lives to find it's nighttime and the show is populated by dead people.
Or it's like...
It's like PvP that's not actually about video games anymore.
Or watching Blake 7 in Seasons 3 and 4 when Blake wasn't there.
Yeah.
Now, the 2000th comic was mostly on the station.
Which is good. Again, I'm not judging, I'm not complaining, it's just an observation.
No, you're right. They appear a lot.
Hey, here's an idea. I heard a rumor you're going to kill off the characters on the station and bring in a new cast, entirely made up of Rumor Mongers.
That rumor is false.
How do you know?
I'm
I know it's true because a small blue lump in the ground told me it was true.
But they're not always right. They get a lot of stuff wrong.
What about the one with the goatee who's from the parallel universe?
He gets stuff wrong too.
Well, I choose to believe a small blue lump.
Okay, so okay. I think we've gone past the time limit for this episode. So
yeah,
let's wrap it up. And Tara, it would be great if you could join us again sometime.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Good.
I think she was definitely going to join us again until I turned up.
All right, then.
Sorry, was I supposed to say, oh, no.
I think that was what he was fishing for, I don't know.
Tara, you don't need to lie to us. We know we suck. I know I suck.
She's not a Subway girl that you know, swoons at the sound of your voice, unfortunately.
How many people
got
that?
You like Terry Pratchett, so that's all okay.
It's true. You know, I was raised on a diet of sci-fi, fantasy, and gruel.
I totally grew up with Star Trek. Totally. That was ritual in my household. Every weekend.
Oh, yes.
It was Saturday morning, Saturday evenings by the time... That's how I was growing up, and every Saturday we would have to be home in time to catch Star Trek. I can remember being, for some reason, I have a memory of watching a Star Trek episode as like one of the little film strips or movies that they show in elementary school when they've got nothing better to do and they put all the kids in the gym and put on a movie. And of course, back then it was one of the big film canister type movies as opposed to where you just stick the video in the machine.
I know,
but I remember seeing a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, I did too.
Why were they showing Star Trek episodes to little kids?
There were at least a handful of them that were out on 16mm. I remember seeing Shore Leave on 16mm that way.
Oh yeah.
And what I remember most is, you know, being, I don't know, I couldn't have been older than 9, because my elementary school went up to grade 4. And I remember watching it and thinking, geez, Captain Kirk always manages to rip his shirt. And how did I get something called Star Trek? That's
fine. And he doesn't have any nipples. He has no nipples.
He rips his shirt to show that off.
I don't recall that I looked carefully enough.
Now, is he going to rip his shirt in the new movie?
Yes.
All right.
Try remembering the trailer. Has everybody seen the trailer?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw it on the big screen. Very nice.
I saw it on an iPhone. Because when I went to see Quantum of Solace, I was one of the 25% of prints that did not have it.
Oh.
Wow.
Did not have the trailer. So I was quite disappointed. I was really looking forward to seeing it on the big screen. We didn't bloody get the smugging soddy thing. So I had to make do with watching it on an iPhone. And then I watched it again on my PC on the Star Trek website. And the only I will be truthful with you. The only reason I wanted to see that film before was Simon Pegg as Scotty. Now that trailer makes me want to actually see the film properly. Like, the whole thing, not just the bits with Scotty in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's...
I don't know. I'm not excited yet because it just looks kind of generic science fiction. Things blow up and people are screaming, and it doesn't yet say to me Star Trek. In fact, I think the first trailer said more about the. It had more of the feeling of promise, of hope, and all that kind of thing that I liked about Star Trek. And you know, blowing up stuff. All the movies do that. That's not interesting.
This is the first time we've seen Kirk as a kid driving a car over a cliff.
That's true.
I actually had a friend of mine point out an interesting continuity error with that, in that segment, young Kirk knows how to drive a car, and there is an episode of Classic Trek where he is put in a position where he needs to drive a car and he does not know how it works. I'm sure Tom knows.
You're right, yes.
More specifically.
Well, now to be fair, he didn't know how to not drive over a cliff. So, he wasn't fair very good at driving.
Perhaps he had his memory erased.
City
on the Edge of Forever, yeah.
No, Piece of the Action, actually.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
you're right.
When he tries to drive the mobster car. Yeah, I think they're going to be following regular Star Trek continuity with this movie.
Do you think this is a reboot? Because I've heard people describe it as a half reboot. To which I was wondering, how would you half reboot something? It's not an Amiga, it doesn't work that way.
Half reboot's when you take out all the good parts and leave the crap?
Other
way around.
It's like upgrading from Windows 98 to Windows Millennium Edition.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I cracked out the old one there.
Yes. So this is Star Trek Millennium Edition then, is it?
Depends, we haven't seen it. We might be lucky, it might be Star Trek Vista.
Ah. So the movie will stop every now and then.
Well, no, it's an odd numbered movie.
No,
It'll stop every now and then and say, are you sure you want to continue watching this? Yes, no.
Star Trek Vista is really good once you've got it properly house trained, and it's a good one. If you have to do a clean install, if you upgrade from Star Trek XP, then it's not going to work. You're going to have all kinds of compatibility issues.
So if you saw Enterprise, you got to forget it.
Yeah, well, that's probably for best, even if you don't watch the new Star Trek film.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
So this has been Pod Warp 1999.
Yes, it has.
Weren't you going to say goodbye like 7 minutes ago?
Oh, probably.
It's a tangent. You know how that goes.
It is.
Yeah.
I do. I'm normally the instigator for most of the tangents.
This has been Tangent 1999 with Podwarp. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or feedback, you can email us at podwarp1999@comicostrich.com, or you can join us in the forums at forum.comicostrich.com. And that's my part done, so someone else say something now.
I suppose I should do the outro. We have been people. Goodbye.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye. We'll be right back.
Man, you get out of doing the opening, and now you get out of doing the closing. I don't know.
How long ago did we lose Jim?
The intro and outro music is Earth's Assault on the Central AI by Tetix from the album Technology Crisis. A link to Tetix's website is available on the Podwarp 1999 website.